bruised and battered, I couldn't tell what I felt. I was unrecognizable to myself. I saw my reflection in a window and didn't know my own face. Oh brother, are you gonna leave me wasting away on the streets of Philadelphia?
As celebrations get underway for America 250, many of us look back to remember the celebration of the bicentennial in 1976. This morning, we go back further to 1876 as the United States marks its centennial amid lingering divisions from the Civil War. Philadelphia hosted a World's Fair unlike any the nation had ever seen. In his new book, Centennial, Fergus Bordowich explores how that six-month exposition introduced millions of Americans to transformative new technologies, global cultures, and a vision of modern progress. Bordowich is an acclaimed historian and the author of Clan War, The First Congress, and Bound for Canaan. The new book is Centennial, The Great Fair of 1876 and the Invention of America's Future. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Fergus Bordowich back to the roundtable. Fergus, thank you very much for being with us. What a pleasure to have you back on our program.
Good afternoon, Joe. I'm very happy to be with you.
Always a pleasure to have you on our airwaves. Give me a sense of the excitement that went into the centennial of 1876.
The centennial, and everybody called it just the centennial. It had a longer, more formal name, but people would say, I'm going to the centennial. Have you been to the centennial? And so on. It was spectacular. It was phantasmagoric. One newspaper referred to it as the Arabian Nights of modern times. It was huge in both area and intent. It occupied Fairmount Park in Philadelphia. That's a park comparable with Central Park in New York.
Yeah.
Probably not quite as large. There were 200 buildings. Many of them were spectacular works of architecture that resembled buildings something like the great iron and steel train sheds in Europe that are still standing. The largest building, the main hall, was the largest building in the world at the time. It was 1,900 feet long and 500 feet wide. These buildings, 200 of them, as I said, were packed with exhibits, American arts, the world's arts, the cultures of the world, and so on. And 20% of the American population visited the centennial. Everybody went. Every newspaper in the United States carried a centennial column day after day.
One of the things that fascinated me, I grew up in Philadelphia, and Fairmount Park was such a part of my youth. So many of those buildings are still there, still standing, and very much a reflection of that time. As you said, these were massive structures. It was beautiful. But boy, you think about it, and in reading the book, you describe this, of what it took to get it ready for such a centennial event.
Well, it was planned, not surprisingly, for several years. There was the question of who was going to pay for it, and money came from different sources. But the biggest chunk came from the Pennsylvania Railroad and its friends. The Pennsylvania Railroad was the biggest corporation in the world at the time. And if you think about it, as the planners did, every single visitor would be coming to the centennial on the Pennsylvania Railroad or one of its subsidiaries. So the railroad had an enormous investment in this and twisted political arms to make it happen. The federal government finally, somewhat grudgingly, put money into it. But the underlying question was, what was this thing really supposed to be? What was this animal, the centennial? It marked the first century of the United States. And the planners intended it to be more than a big show. It was a big show. But they also saw it as a kind of stock-taking of America over its first century. Who were we? Who are we? Where are we going? So it's looking forward into the 20th century, as well as back towards the founding. So there's a kind of cultural or intellectual underpinning to this besides it being spectacular industrial show.
And so much of it was a World's Fair comparable event. But when you think about 10 million Americans, 20% of the population, as you mentioned, among them, P.T. Barnum, Frederick Douglass, and Mark Twain, quite a group.
Yes, indeed. Well, as I said, virtually everybody went. And that list could be extended ad infinitum.
Absolutely.
George Armstrong Custer was there just weeks before he and his command were wiped out in Montana. And I write about a number of fairly significant Americans who in one way or another showed up at, participated in, or commented on the centennial. Walt Whitman, among many, who took both a celebratory and a caustic view simultaneously, and both presidential aspirants of that watershed year, 1876, Rutherford B. Hayes, the Republican, who would finally triumph by a single electoral vote. Everybody's talking about the campaign, by the way, during that year. And Samuel Tilden, governor of New York, who is the presumed winner, by the way, and is got to be one of the dullest political figures ever to run for national office in the U.S. Challenge to write about, frankly.
So one of the things that I find interesting about this, Fergus, is that it's much less the celebration at what had happened 100 years prior.
Yes, Americans, particularly in the 19th century, are not particularly history-minded people. Americans were then, and one could, I plausibly argue, still are, more oriented toward the future than the past. And this was, in a sense, a unique event in that it was about Americans partly looking back and saying, have we fulfilled what the founders wanted of us? And I think that remained an open question because the centennial turned out not to be a particularly scholarly event. It was a massive celebration primarily of industry, invention, and consumerism. And in that sense, it's a monument to the Gilded Age America in which it takes place. Yes, you could see exhibits of George Washington's belongings, his pants and his camp bed and his sword and such things, and similar items belonging to Ben Franklin and a few Pilgrim's artifacts and so on. The Civil War, only 10 years in the past, looms large. It casts a shadow to some extent over the centennial. Many Southern states boycott the centennial. Other exhibits are very controversial, including almost anything referring to emancipation. America's changing. It's even Northerners are losing interest in race and the South and the civil liberties that were gained after the war. I had thought when I embarked on this that I would find some really profound insight looking back into the evolution of America and whether Americans felt that they had really honored the traditions of the founders. And by and large, as I say, Americans wanted to let go of the past. They wanted to memorialize the founders more than they wanted to think about them.
Another thing, and you touched on this a moment ago, but not only was the Civil War fresh after 10 years, but also, as you said, a highly contested election that determines the fate of Reconstruction and as you say, permanently shapes the Republican Party as we know it today.
The election looms very large as the summer goes along, and the centennial will end almost exactly at the time of the election. Coincidence, but that's the way it worked out. Both parties are in flux. The Democratic Party has not held power for 15 years since before Abraham Lincoln's election. And Democrats, of course, have been tarred with having split over secession and so on. But they are resurgent by 1876. The Democratic Party is more or less the reactionary party of its time. That's to say, it's made up of unreconstructed or only semi-reconstructed Confederates, Northern Copperheads, that's to say Northerners who tended to oppose the war, and the urban working class, particularly, say, in New York, the Irish, certain other minorities, other big city groups. On one hand, the Democrats are trying to shed their Confederate tainted mantle. The Republican Party, which had been very much the progressive, forward-looking, reformist party since the 1850s, has now become the party of the establishment, government, and big money, and is deeply tainted by corruption that has burgeoned during the Gilded Age and during the Grant administration. Ulysses Grant was wrongly treated by many historians of an earlier time as himself a corrupt individual, which is absolutely not the case. He was a straight-up man and a very progressive president in many ways, but his administration was indeed fissured and with corruption, and the Republicans are kind of running against that. So they nominate Rutherford B. Hayes, a reformer, Samuel B. Tilden, J. Tilden, rather. The Democrat is also a reformer. So reform is in the air. Will it lead to reform? That remains an open question. But right up almost until the inauguration, the outcome is unclear. Hayes is traveling to Washington in early 1877, not knowing whether he's actually going to be inaugurated. And Democrats, some Democrats are agitating for an armed intervention in the election and the seizure of the Capitol and the installation of Tilden. There are a lot of controversies involving the vote count and the eligibility of certain electoral votes. Hayes will actually be the winner by only one electoral vote. All very controversial, but I think, in fact, he was justly named the winner. There are historians who have argued about this.
Fergus Bordowicz is our guest. The name of the new book is Centennial, The Great Fair of 1876 and the Invention of America's Future. Looking at the celebration of the centennial, the 100th anniversary of this nation, this event in Fairmount Park in Philadelphia is what you capture in the book. It's what you look at, and it's what so many looked at as the grand celebration. How was the centennial, or was the centennial, celebrated elsewhere? Bicentennial, of course, was something celebrated from sea to shining sea. We have celebrations for America 250 across this country. How about the centennial?
Everything was concentrated in Philadelphia, to put it concisely. I mean, of course, the 4th of July, the holiday, the 4th of July, was celebrated all over America as it was and has been traditionally. In those days, often with long-winded speeches and so forth, as well as things like picnics and hog roasts and things of that sort, with rather much less enthusiasm in the southern states, the Confederacy having just lost its bid to become an independent country. There's a great deal of bitterness in the South. But the national centennial kind of sucked all the air out of the national room in the course of its 6 months. But it should also be said that in 1876, Americans, broadly speaking, were intensely patriotic, really intensely. There was a passion for what America was, for its institutions, that may seem quaint, dare I say, or remote in our considerably more cynical age today. I mean, as you well know, public approval of national institutions, be it Congress or journalism and other spheres, has plummeted. But Americans were not cynical about government. They knew they were the only republic in the world. And Northerners had just prevailed in a war to protect and defend that republic, and indeed to strengthen it. And that era, the Civil War, post-Civil War era, is often called today, sometimes the Second Founding, because it represented a recommitment of Americans to what the founders had initially built. So the country is redolent with a kind of patriotism that is a lot less common today. And I think the centennial year, certainly, I think turbocharged that. It's an anachronism. Nothing was turbocharged in 1876, but it's it's the way it seemed.
How turbocharged, in comparison, how turbocharged do you think things are for this 250th celebration?
Personally, I think the 250th is pretty shambolic. I was waiting for several years to see what kind of plan was going to be proposed for this 250th, and was, I would say, roundly mystified by the absence of plans. I think, frankly, the public celebrations, the public plans are frankly pretty pathetic and embarrassing. But I think what's really lacking, to come to your real question here, what's really been lacking is a serious rethinking. And I don't mean just a critical rethinking, but a rethinking of us as a nation over 250 years, a genuine inventory, a serious deep inventory, which includes celebration, appreciation, honoring of the institutions and the founders. It would be absurd to attempt to celebrate an anniversary like this and then chuck them out as the into the dustbin of history, but also a renewed orientation toward a civic understanding of what life in America is, what the founders intended, of how our institutions function, and they have functioned extremely well, James Madison and others, that conflict and uncertainty were baked into the system. Now, there was no golden age in American history. There's no golden age in the future. Golden ages belong in mythology. And I think as a nation, after 250 years, we ought to be mature enough to look with an absolutely clear and honest eye at our history and its complexities and its shortcomings and so on. It was a disgrace to be tearing information panels off George Washington's house in Philadelphia, where he was president, because they happened to mention that there were enslaved people in the house. It's a disgrace. It's an embarrassment. At 250, why should we tell lies to ourselves, pretend that such things weren't so?
Do we do a better job in 1876 and 1976?
Comparing 1876 to 1976, right?
Well, as far as what you just outlined of taking an opportunity to look at our country's founding and where we are either 100 or 200 years later.
Yeah, I don't think the centennial of 1876 was particularly deeply reflective the way I had hoped it would be. My book goes outward from the great centennial exhibition to look at America and what America was at that time, precisely because the centennial itself didn't really look that deeply. Okay. 1976, I was in New York City. I was in Riverside Park in New York City picnicking with a bunch of friends when the tall ships came up the river. And I don't think the bicentennial either was particularly reflective. I think most Americans, to my recollection, Joe, really wanted to have a big party, and which is kind of what Americans like to do and around the 4th of July. And you know, our present situation, as I already said a few minutes ago, I think we could have done more. We could have done better. We could have thought more deeply and at the same time have been entertaining and honoring our forebears. I mean, look, the tall ships were great in 1976. I can remember it as if it were yesterday. I don't know what they had to do with the bicentennial, except it was a beautiful sight.
Fergus, the book is fantastic. It's Centennial, The Great Fair of 1876 and the Invention of America's Future. It is published by Knopf. Fergus, it's always a great pleasure to have you on the program. Congratulations on the new book, and thank you for sharing with us.
Thank you, Joe, and thanks for having me on again. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. Whoa, whoa, whoa.
When I was given my first command, I led my men into a massacre, witnessed their deaths firsthand. Oh, I made every mistake. I felt the shame rise in me. And even now I lie awake, knowing history, history, history has its eyes on me. History, history, history. History has its eyes on me. History, history, history.
As America marks its 250th anniversary, few historians have done more to shape the way we understand the nation's founding than Ron Chernow. The Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer has brought towering figures to life through acclaimed books on George Washington, Alexander Hamilton, Ulysses S. Grant, and more recently, Mark Twain. His biography of Hamilton inspired the Broadway phenomenon that introduced a new generation to the founding era, while his portrait of Washington remains a definitive account of the nation's first president. As the country reflects on its past, Chernow offers a unique perspective on the ideals, contradictions, and personalities, including Mark Twain, that helped create the United States and how these stories continue to resonate 2.5 centuries later. It is a great honor to welcome Ron Chernow back to the roundtable. Thank you very much. A delight to have you here.
Thank you, Joe. You know, the Hamilton musical goes on and on. It's almost 11 years now that it's been on in New York. It continues to sell out every night. And I think that the most important thing that we accomplished with the show was that we got millions of people reading American history. A lot of people thought American history was dull, where they remembered their American history classes as particularly vacuous exercises. And then they, as adults, they start reading history for themselves, and lo and behold, they find out it's fascinating and full of colorful characters.
Congratulations.
Yeah. So, Ron, it's just a real honor to talk to you. You know, the people like me don't get this chance very often, so I'm going to seize it and talk to you about my favorite topic, which is late 18th century America. So you're well known for exhaustive research and great storytelling. You spent more than a decade with these two figures. And by the two figures, I'm talking about Hamilton and Washington. You've said, and I heard you say, tongue in cheek, of course, that you probably know more about George Washington than Martha does, and more about Alexander Hamilton than Eliza did. So I've got to ask you this question. As you woke up every morning over this decade of spending time with these two characters, which story is the more compelling to you? Is it Hamilton's, which was fascinating, bastard to early death, or Washington, who had all sorts of interesting parts of his life?
It's very hard to say. You know, at first glance, Hamilton's life seems more astounding and improbable. Illegitimate kid from the West Indies comes to North America, doesn't know a soul, you know, and just by dint of his intelligence and drive and ambition, suddenly ends up playing not only the central role in the American Revolution, but then the Constitutional Convention and the forging of the federal government. On the other hand, the story of George Washington is no less fascinating, because when you read about George Washington as a young man, when he was in his 20s and 30s, he was not always an attractive character. He was trying to amass as much land as he could, as many enslaved people as he could. And so you see a process of growth that takes place in him slowly, imperceptibly, but he ends up from this really rather, you know, pushy character that he was as a young man to someone of tremendous wisdom. And of all the founders, and the founding era ended up being as partisan as anything going on today, unfortunately. But the only one who really tried and often succeeded to kind of levitate above all the partisanship and really keep the national interest first in his mind was George Washington. So studying his early life, one would never have imagined that he would become a figure of such wisdom and integrity and stature. So they're both mysterious stories. They very much complemented each other. Hamilton had that kind of technocratic and legal brilliance. Washington had the one thing that Hamilton lacked, which was judgment. And so as long as Alexander Hamilton was operating directly under the supervision of George Washington, he seemed quite faultless. As soon as Washington leaves as president, and then the remainder of Hamilton's life, he commits one terrible indiscretion and act of judgment after another. So the two men really needed each other. Washington was very aware of what he always referred to as his defective education. Hamilton had gone to what became Columbia and John Adams Harvard, you know, et cetera, et cetera. The other founders were all very well educated. Washington's father died when he was 10 or 11. He was much more of a self-made man and an autodidact. So luckily they found each other. And I think that when Washington met Hamilton, he recognized kind of a younger version of himself, someone with tremendous drive and ambition. In fact, when I was working on the show with Lin-Manuel Miranda, he said to me one day, he was trying to figure out the Washington-Hamilton relationship in the show. And he said to me, Ron, would Washington, when he met Hamilton, have seen Hamilton as a younger version of himself? And I said, absolutely. And I started telling him, when Washington was 22, he was the head of all the armed forces in Virginia. He led his men into a massacre. Anyway, the next version of the show that I see in rehearsal, suddenly Washington is coming out and singing, "Let me tell you what I wish I'd known when I was young and dreamed of glory. You've no control. Who lives, who dies, who tells your story?" And then he tells about the massacre at Fort Necessity that had haunted him his entire life.
That's fantastic. Let me follow this up with one other question. These are unfair questions that they ask you to speculate on things, but you're the expert here. So these two figures have, as you just said, historically and famously different personalities, right? Hamilton is brash, he's outspoken, he's sort of irritating, and he's quite emotional. Washington is stoic and controlled, rigid, and until your book, largely unknowable, right? Who navigates our current political and social landscape better? Like, which one, based on their personality traits, is better able to adapt to our current world?
I often wonder what would happen if an Alexander Hamilton were alive today. I think the last place in the world that you would find him would be in politics, frankly. What happened during our founding era was that we had constitutions to write, institutions to create, principles to create, a government to forge. And so even though the population of the country was less than 3 million, the greatest minds of the era were drawn into politics because of these momentous actions that had to be taken. I think today, Hamilton, Madison, and Adams, the last place that you would find them would be in politics, because now people who are that creative and outspoken would be considered threatening. So Hamilton would probably be out in Silicon Valley or maybe doing buyouts on Wall Street or doing biotech research. I think that anything other than Washington is kind of full of groupthink at the moment, often at a rather shallow level. Whereas these people were permitted, because of the time as well as their own individual talents, they were permitted to act as philosopher kings, give speeches, to write essays, sketching out a very, very broad vision of American society. So I fear that there would not be much room for them in American politics. I hope that changes.
In writing about, as we mentioned, Washington and Hamilton, and the most recent book is about Mark Twain, and while some may look at that as a departure, it really isn't, is it?
No, in fact, many people, when I told them I was reading Mark Twain, said, "Oh, this is such a change for you." And I said, not really, because there's a lot of business. Mark Twain was a money-mad character. When he was not satirizing the rich, he was trying to become one. And he was very, very political and increasingly engaged in many, many political crusades during the course of his life. So I didn't feel that I was operating under such different terrain. Of course, Mark Twain published 24 books in about 1,000 or 2,000 magazine articles, which George Washington or Alexander Hamilton did not. So that there were some very, very significant differences. Mark Twain's life was very, very wide ranging in ways that people, I think, really didn't appreciate.
You quote him as saying, "I am not an American, I am the American." Well, that's a quote because it tells us a lot about him. But what do you think then with that information? Again, a speculative question, as Bo mentioned, of what he would make of this moment of 250 years.
Well, I think that he would have very, very complicated moments. On the one hand, Mark Twain marveled at all the technological advances of his age, the telephone, the telegraph, the phonograph, et cetera, et cetera. You know, he loved gadgetry. He proudly said, "There are more inventions now in 1 year in America than in all of Methuselah's life." And so he loved that kind of dynamic of constant technological change. So there's no question he would be fascinated by smartphones and AI and all of the other high-tech gadgetry that we have today. On the other hand, and actually Mark Twain himself was an inventor, kind of small-time inventor. He invented a bed clamp so that children could not throw off their bedclothes. He invented a self-pasting scrapbook that already had the adhesive in there. You didn't need to bother with glue pots. But Mark Twain had this fatally alluring fantasy of becoming a tycoon. And so he ended up as a venture capitalist, really, financing the creation of a typesetting machine invented by a man named James W. Page. Now, the Page typesetter could replace five or six newspaper printers. Mark Twain was convinced that this would revolutionize the newspaper business and would make him one of the richest men in America. It was a fiendishly complex machine. It had 18,000 separate parts, but it lacked the one thing that every newspaper would demand in a typesetter: reliability. It constantly broke down. And so the industry standard became something called the Linotype, developed by a man named Mergenthaler. But Twain had spent so many years and so much money financing this typesetter that he lost in contemporary dollars over $6 million in this. It not only wiped out most of his fortune from book royalties and lecture fees, but his wife Livy was an heiress. It wiped out her inheritance. They lost every penny on the Page typesetter, and it was one of the things that pushed Mark Twain into bankruptcy. So even though we know that, he made all of these scathing comments about the plutocrats of his day, he said, "Before Jay Gould, American people desired money, but he made them bow down and worship it." Or he said of Vanderbilt, he said Vanderbilt turned money into his god instead of his servant. So we know that he would be appalled by a lot of the greed going on. I think he would be appalled by all the billionaires surrounding Donald Trump down at Mar-a-Lago, and particularly this kind of oligarchy that we see forming between big business and big government. There's no question that he would be disturbed by that. But I also think that it's important to understand that Mark Twain was satirizing the Gilded Age. He actually coined the term the Gilded Age. So in terms of our second Gilded Age, I think we have to remember that he would be critical of all this greed. He'd be critical of all this political corruption in Washington, but that he himself is also a product of this system and was very preoccupied with making money and coming up with different technological devices.
Ron, let me ask this question. It's fascinating to me that over the arc of your career, you've written about characters that I would describe as nation builders, right? So Hamilton and Washington are obvious nation builders at a
Right.
time, as you said 10 minutes ago, at a time in which you had to build a nation. But Twain helped to build the nation in a narrative sense. What's fascinated you about the nation building process? And do you see any characteristics on the horizon about sort of a rebuilding of the nation today?
Well, that last question is the tough one. There are a million fascinating stories of individuals out there. But what I have looked for in a story, because very often people will come up to me and say, "Ron, I have your next book." And they'll tell me a story about someone I've never heard of, full of amazing tales and adventures. And I'll say to them, "That's the most extraordinary story I've ever heard." said, "They'll say, is that your next book?" I said, "No, because I don't feel that the world was different for that person having lived. I don't feel that there's a mighty story without a mighty theme at the center of it." Yes, I mean, the tales of Alexander Hamilton's life are extraordinary, but what elevates it to another plane and engages our interest is that he's growing up at the same time the country is growing up, and those two processes become intertwined. That kind of involves us as well as him. It makes it our story as well as his story. And that's what I look for, because there are not many people where you feel, had that person not lived, that the world would have not been different.
Our guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer Ron Chernow. His latest book is Mark Twain, now out in paperback. We'll continue our conversation after this short break. Welcome back to our conversation with historian Ron Chernow. We talk about this moment of America at 250. A lot of us are trying to figure it out, figure out how we celebrate. We heard earlier from Fergus Bordowich about the centennial in 1876, an event Mark Twain attended. Sensing we are a long way from that mood, I asked Ron how things are different 50 years later since we celebrated in 1976.
Yeah, I think that we've gone through a period where, on the one hand, particularly in academia, there's been much more of a tendency in historiography to be critical of American history and to focus on racial discrimination, sexual discrimination, et cetera, et cetera, and kind of more a bottoms up rather than a top down approach to looking at American history. So, kind of a tendency to look more at America's failures than its accomplishments. And then you have kind of, you know, over on the MAGA side, the other extreme of only wanting to celebrate and only wanting to overlook the history of American failures and the various, you know, forms of oppression and discrimination that have happened. What I have tried to do in my book is to and find the middle ground before that. I've always had a policy, and this was true, let's say, with Alexander Hamilton, that if I do a book that is an admiring book on someone, I go out of my way to tell you every bad thing the person did, you know, with Hamilton, whether it's the Reynolds scandal or the open letter to John. I mean, I go through all of that. Why? Because I feel that if an admiring portrait is going to be convincing, it has to present and acknowledge and accept the bad side. And I think what I feel about the people that I've written about is that great people can carry the weight of their own defects, the weight of their vices, and people will be able to still appreciate them. In fact, they'll seem much more human because of that. If you do a kind of whitewashed, you know, portrait of a person or the country, it will seem unbelievable. And in the same way that I feel that individual characters in our history can carry the weight of their own flaws, I feel that America can carry the weight of their own flaws. We have plenty of things in American history, you know, winning world wars, the Marshall Plan, interstate highway system, sending a man to, you know, on and on and on, all of these extraordinary accomplishments that we've had. So there's no shortage, going back, of course, both to the Declaration and the Constitution. And so I'm hoping that we can arrive at a new moment of maturity where we can accept both the good and the bad in the nation's story. And very often they're intertwined. One of the things that fascinated me about Mark Twain was that he is so contradictory. You know, our major critic of the Gilded Age is at the same time much more like the characters that he's satirizing than most people realize. That he, one of his most famous characters, Colonel Sellers, who's this money-mad humbug in the Gilded Age, his expression always is that he sees millions. He sees millions in every, you know, business project. And Twain kept writing out Colonel Sellers many times in books and plays. And yet there was a large streak of that in Mark Twain. that one after another, he would pour money into some business project that would blow up in his face. And I think, you know, Joe, you mentioned the famous quote, you know, I am not an American, I am the American. He is a quintessential American. And I think that he's a quintessential American because he seems to embody all the contradictions in our national character. He has a lot of the best, but also some of the worst in national character. And I think that Twain, having grown up literally in the heartland in Missouri, so he was living smack in the middle of the country. But I think that Mark Twain, who did a lot of traveling, really had a sense of the national character and what a cast of characters he brought before our eyes.
Ron, so you write about gripping characters, right, as we've talked about. But a lot of the listeners consider you a gripping character. And I'll quote Twain himself by saying, you're not just an historian, you're the historian. So can I ask you a question about your process, a quick question about your process? You famously use note cards and you sort of line them up in your work and you do the exhaustive research. Tell me your emotions as you finish the book. Are you tired of these people? Are you exhausted? Are you even more intrigued about the characters you spend years and years studying?
It's a very good question because very often people will say to me, do you feel sad when you finish the book? You know, you've spent all these years. The person, my reaction is, hell no, I'm so relieved. You know, these are such gigantic research processes. I always say the hard drive of my mind can kind of hold one big book at a time, but I'm trying to keep suspended in my mind all of this, you know, thousands and thousands of pieces of information. And my mind is rebelling. My mind is kind of shouting out, give us a rest here. And so it's almost like kind of the sediment settles down to the bottom as soon as I stop writing it. And it's a very, you know, writing a biography of these figures is very emotional. You have to understand, I end up spending more time with these characters, again, than their spouses or children or parents. And I'm locked in a room with them day after day after day. And when you write about something, you're going to discover things that pleasantly surprise you that you didn't suspect. You also will find some things that really shock you. So it's a real wild pendulum swing of the emotions. And I go one day, oh, he's the greatest. And then the next day I'm scandalized by what I'm reading. So it's pretty exhausting. I know that I'm ready to write when that pendulum swing stops. And then I'm not being either gratified or shocked anymore, but I'm discovering, I feel like I know the person. But I have to say, Bob, that, you know, one of the reasons that I became a biographer is that I feel that I write about people whose lives are much more dramatic than my own. And I'm always a little bit bashful talking about my life. And I think, like a lot of biographers, I hide behind my subject, and I'm happy in that. I get to come on nice shows like this. You know, because really, sometimes when I speak to writing students, I use the term, perhaps old fashioned now, second story man. Remember, they used to call burglars second story man. So I say to them, okay, you're going to be like a second story man when you're writing about someone. You're going to break into their house in the middle of the night. It's dark. You find your way over to the drawers. You start rummaging through the drawers. And most people will have incriminating things in their drawers, maybe guns, maybe pornography. I don't know. Who knows? You know what you'll do. But you're going to find something that every life has its secrets. And so I don't know. It would be very, very difficult, I have to say, if someone were suddenly to write a biography of me. And Mark Twain was very, very hostile to people who want to write biographies. He said that biographies are but the clothes and buttons of the man. The biography of the man himself cannot be written.
Let me ask this, the final question, which we're asking, Ron, we're asking all of our guests in this series, and I'd love to get your reaction to it. Which is the most indispensable for the story of America at 250, the Declaration or the Constitution?
Oh, that's a really good question, because the Declaration expresses certain enduring ideals. One thing that people don't know about the Declaration, you would know this, but most people, you know, don't, is that at the time that it was published, the famous lines at the beginning that we can constantly quote, they were seen like as a rhetorical flourish, not the important stuff. The important stuff was then followed by a couple of dozen grievances against George III. So that kind of legalese thing was much more important. So it's basically, it's an idealistic document in terms of what is expressed. The Constitution is much more of a compromise document. Famously or infamously, it incorporates slavery into the Constitution through the Fugitive Slave Act and the federal ratio, et cetera, et cetera. So in fact, what happened, it's interesting, just the lives of these two documents. Abraham Lincoln always talked about the Declaration of Independence, didn't talk about the Constitution because the Constitution seemed flawed. The Constitution seemed tainted by its acceptance of slavery, although the word slavery itself is never used. And so what happened was during the abolitionist movement, William Lloyd Garrison called the Constitution a covenant with death and an agreement with hell. On the other hand, Frederick Douglass said it was a glorious liberty document. So there was a debate about the Constitution. But then what happened was that after the Civil War, we have the 13th Amendment abolishing slavery, 14th Amendment equal process, you know, due process, equal rights before the law, and then 15th that gave Black men the right to vote. So it really substantially transforms the definition of citizenship. And it's a process that is still unfinished, but it's really that we live under, and I think that the great gift that the founders gave us was that they bequeathed to us a process that we have to continually maintain and revive and improve. It's a never-ending thing. It's not linear. Sometimes it seems like two steps forward, one step back. Sometimes it seems like one step forward, two steps back, but we kind of have to keep going with that. And as I always remind people, the preamble to the Constitution does not say we the people in order to form a perfect union. It says in order to form a more perfect union. So they, in fact, it's interesting. Washington thought the Constitution would last about 20 years.
Yeah.
Ditto for Hamilton.
So did Jefferson. Yeah.
So Jefferson. Yeah. And this famous story of Ben Franklin walking out of the State House after the Constitutional Convention and meets a woman on Chestnut Street. And she says, Dr. Franklin, what have you brought forth? And he says, a republic, madam, if you can keep it. You know, so there was this kind of doubt. They didn't realize that they were writing something for the ages. I think they'd be pleased, but also quite astounded.
Definitely.
That 2-4 years later, that this document was still governing our lives.
Even Madison would be astounded.
I think so. Yeah, absolutely.
Ron Chernow is our guest. The latest book is Mark Twain. It is just out in paperback from Penguin. Ron Chernow, what a great pleasure to have you back on the program, to have you join us on this special occasion. It means so much to both of us, and I so appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Joe. Always nice to do your show. You're a class act. And thank you, Bo, meeting you.
Thank you very much.
Happy holiday.
Saw the wandering eye inside my heart, shouts and battle cries from every part. I can see those tears, everyone is true. When the dawn appears, I'll go right through. A small dark room where I will wait, face to face I find, I contemplate. Even though a man is made of clay, everything can change that one fine day. city on a hill. I complete my tasks one by one. I remove my masks when I am done. Then a piece of mind fell over me. In these troubled times, we still can see. We can use the stars to guide the way. It is not that far, that one fine day. One fine day. One fine day.
One Fine Day by David Byrne. 250 years on, we inherit both promise and responsibility. May courage outlast division, liberty welcome every voice, and tomorrow reward those determined enough to build it together. This program was written and curated by Joe Donahue and Bo Breslin. It was produced by Madeline Reynolds. Bailey Janes is our engineer. I'm Joe Donahue. Have a beautiful holiday. Stay safe and stay tuned for Midday Magazine.